Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It continued to worsen during the pandemic, and we're going to have to address it when we finish. And we're talking about opioid addiction. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Thanks for having
me, doc,
on the show.
I appreciate your time, doctor. I really do. Professor of medicine at Stanford. I guess let's talk about what's been going on with the opioid epidemic during the COVID pandemic.
Well, I think that it's clear to many people that the opioid crisis is not going away. And in fact, the pandemic of COVID-19 has placed the sort of strains and stresses on our society that are in some ways a breeding place for opioid use disorder, what we used to call opioid addiction. And we are still living in the legacy of the 1990s and 2000s, where opioid prescribing increased dramatically. And in so doing, I think placed a lot of people at risk, not only for opioid use disorder or addiction, but also overdose and all the other harms who've come along with the opioid crisis. And this hasn't gotten any better with COVID. I think the fact that our economy is in shambles at present is hurting people even more.
And I shouldn't have called it an epidemic because it's certainly not contagious. In terms of the rules, the regulations, I guess, that were enforced, it's become stricter for physicians to prescribe opioids. The numbers continue to go up, though, right? So does that indicate that that was not the right thing to do, or it was, and it would have been worse beyond that?
Well, there's a bit of a paradox. Opioid prescribing really did peak in around 2010 or so. And since then, we've had at first some relatively slow reductions in prescribing of opioids and then some rapid reductions over the last 5 years. But nonetheless, the problems of opioids are still there. And in many cases, this means that people are simply switched from one source of opioids, those prescribed by doctors, to other sources such as heroin and fentanyl, which are available on the black market. So in some sense, the prescribing created this need and this market for opioids that's still being fulfilled. And if we look at some of the ultimate harms of opioids, like overdose or emergency room visits, hospitalizations, those are still going up. And that's a complex issue, but I think the bottom line is we're still living with the legacy of a period of time in this country where prescribing of opioids was somehow condoned and thought to be the right thing to do. I think we know better now, but we're still living with that legacy.
For the most part, does it all begin with a prescription of opioids from a doctor, and then if that's what leads to the fake prescription meds or the fentanyl, et cetera? Or do people just somehow on their own find their way to these substances?
Well, there are many pathways, and, you know, it's really hard to generalize and say that there's just one path that people move towards when they become hooked on illicit opioids. But it is true that many people who are heroin users do report that they started with prescribed opioids. So it's very clear that that's a prominent way in which people move towards the use of illicit opioids. And of course, that is kind of the dominant mode right now and causing the most harms. You know, because as I said, prescribing of opioids by physicians, you know, in some ways we've gotten a handle on that. But what we haven't gotten a handle on is the fact that once deprived of that source of opioids, many people with opioid use disorder will simply look for other sources. One of the most pressing problems is that increasingly fentanyl, which is a very potent opioid, it's a called a synthetic opioid, and its ability to create the effects of opioids occur at a very small dose, very small compared to things like morphine or even heroin. The problem is that much of the what's labeled as heroin is a combination of fentanyl and other opioids. Sometimes what's labeled as heroin on the street doesn't even contain the drug heroin. It's much more about fentanyl these days. And the problem is, because of that potency, that ability to cause problems at a very low dosage, there's a lot more danger of people using fentanyl-containing combinations because it's very easy to overdose and very hard to get the exact dose that's going to keep the withdrawal symptoms at bay and produce the high people are looking for. But, you know, often there's a high risk of overdose because these drugs are so potent.
Yeah, again, I know each case is different, but generally speaking, the people that advance to fentanyl and heroin, they're not in chronic pain looking for help. These are situations where the pain has gone away and now it's just about the high that they get from the opioid?
Well, I would say it's a little more complex than that. I think as people get treated for chronic pain, opioids don't necessarily do a good job of effectively treating that pain. So what you really have is sort of a combination of people who are still suffering from pain disorders, but who are now misusing and have opioid use disorder. So, you know, in some ways you have this cluster of things. The pain doesn't necessarily go away with the start of opioid use disorder.
Is there an age, a median age, or a demographic between this and this that where most people that abuse opioids would fall into?
Well, it's very widespread. I think if we look across demographics by gender, by age, by race, ethnicity, we see that, you know, kind of all segments of society are affected. Now, at the same time, those who are economically disadvantaged seem to have worse effects of opioids, and some of the most pressing problems are in lower socioeconomic communities. Now, you know, that puts a lot of strain on minority communities, but at the same time, there's a lot of information that suggests that middle-aged white men are actually the demographic most affected by the opioid epidemic. So this is very widespread. I think that if we think about the harms that are being done, some of that does concentrate in lower socioeconomic communities, both white as well as minority communities. But the problem is widespread. No one is immune from this.
I'm reading a story here from the Washington Post. A colleague of yours, Daniel Cicerone, I think is his name, professor of family community medicine, University of California at San Francisco, says we're going to realize the crisis is still big, still growing. It's morphing in different ways, and we kind of lost track of it for a year, I guess because of the pandemic. Has it been off of the radar, and has it changed, Doctor?
Well, it's definitely changing. I think what Professor Cicerone is talking about is the incredible impact that fentanyl and actually a few other of these synthetic opioids are having. If we look at overdose deaths, deaths involving fentanyl are now number one. And that wasn't true a decade ago. A decade ago, it was still a combination of heroin and prescribed opioids. But now we're really talking about fentanyl getting out of hand and wrecking havoc in terms of overdose deaths and hospitalizations, emergency room visits. I think to some extent we maybe thought that it was under control. And I think that even going back to the era of, 2011 to 15, I think the perception was that once we had gotten prescribing of opioids under control, everything else would settle down. But that simply hasn't been the case. Again, I think part of that is this idea that people will substitute whatever opioids they can find. And then the advent and the powerful impact of fentanyl has really changed the risks of illicit opioid use these days.
So if we were to go to the very starting point, would it begin with the way we approach pain management?
Well, I think we really have to look for the deep roots of this problem. And, some of those are even beyond the issue of pain and opioids. I think as a country, we look for simple solutions. And in some ways, opioids were seen as a simple solution to a very complex problem, which is not only kind of the physiology of pain, but it's also the social structure and the breakdown of that structure that makes people vulnerable. I think that desire for an easy solution and putting the pressure on physicians to solve that problem, I think in some ways are at the heart of the opioid epidemic. Put on top of that, a drug marketplace, a pharmaceutical marketplace, which allows companies to heavily market drugs that aren't necessarily that effective. I think that these are all kind of combining factors that made it very easy for the use of opioids, initially prescription opioids and later illicit opioids, allowed that to occur in a way that doesn't happen the same way in other countries.
And, I misused the word epidemic before, but the difference between epidemic and a pandemic.
I think that's actually an appropriate term. Simply means something that is so prevalent that it's causing harms that are felt by the whole society.
But is it a lot worse here in the United States than it is in other countries?
Well, if you go back and look at opioid prescribing, opioid prescribing at its peak, again, around 2010, was much higher in the United States than, essentially most other places in the world. So if you compare us to Canada, again, far more opioids being prescribed here. So no country is immune to this, but the level of opioid use disorder and the harms from opioid use are much greater in the United States than, let's say, Canada or Western Europe.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back. If you have any questions or comments, you can text them to our WWL Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870, particularly if you have been addicted to opioids. I'd like to know how it started or how it got there, or somebody you know, or is in your family. We're talking about the opioid epidemic that has not gone away with the coronavirus pandemic, which in a way is changing. And maybe it might have even gotten worse. Our guest is Randall Stafford, a professor of medicine at Stanford. And we'll be back in a flash here on WWL. 9:29, we're talking to Dr. Randall Stafford, professor of medicine at Stanford, about the opioid crisis and the coronavirus pandemic, how that opioid crisis has continued to rage on and has gotten even worse and changed somewhat. Dr. Stafford, when it comes to the physician, I'm thinking ultimately, and I hate to say this, but a doctor's practice is a small business. It is, and there are salaries to pay, and a doctor might have student loan to pay, et cetera. And the only reason I bring all that up is student debt is that a patient goes to a doctor because something is bothering them and they want to feel better. So the doctor says, well, I can make you feel better, and he wants the patient to keep coming back, right? He wants the patient to be satisfied with their treatment. So where does that factor into this in terms of the physician thinking, well, it's going to take the pain away. It's not going to fix maybe what the long-term problem is, but it'll keep you coming back. Is that kind of like a dirty little secret of all of this?
Well, I think that does play a role. But I think it's also important to recognize that kind of what we know about opioids now, we didn't necessarily know in the 1990s when this kind of epidemic of opioid prescribing was really taking off. So, you know, I think that you're absolutely right that kind of our consumer-oriented healthcare system does place a lot of pressure on physicians to keep their patients satisfied. And certainly in many cases, it's very difficult to tell somebody that you're not going to prescribe them a narcotic when they've received that same prescription in the past and had a good outcome with it. And I've faced this in my own practice. It's hard to say no. I think ultimately it's the right thing to do. And, you know, to some degree, because of all the pressure on physicians that has occurred really over the last 10 years, it's much easier to say no now. And I don't have too much difficulty convincing patients that it may not necessarily be worth the risk for the pain control that they receive, at least on a temporary basis. But I think you're pointing out something about, you know, how we run our healthcare system. And part of that does rely on consumers making choices about who they go see. And certainly we see the problem of doctor shopping for opioids. Not as prominent now as it used to be, because as I said, I can say no a lot more easily. But there was a time when patients would potentially look for a new doctor if the doctor wasn't willing to prescribe opioids. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think, you know, we have to think about the marketing of pharmaceuticals and how pharmaceuticals in some ways are the go-to solution for very complex problems. And often the actual solutions are much more complicated. So I think we're kind of, in some ways, the opioid crisis has been eye-opening in terms of some of these issues about how our healthcare system works.
So you said middle-aged white men, I guess primarily, if I'm not quoting you incorrectly here. But what about the aging of baby boomers? Because everybody wants to stay active. Everybody, and I had a knee replacement recently. Or I had both replaced. But everybody wants to stay young or active at least. Nobody wants to be in pain. Does the aging baby boomer population figure into this at all?
You know, I'm not sure how that plays in. I think that's an interesting possibility. I think we are oriented towards staying active. But, you know, I think that people who are active are less likely to go on to have these chronic pain syndromes. So, I think that I would encourage people to keep active. But, there are some downsides to physical activity, and, you know, people need to protect themselves against injury.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can look at this from the supply side and from the demand side, right? So when it comes to decreasing demand, it seems like that's almost futile, because no matter what, somebody's going to find a way to get it here. Maybe you might make inroads here or there and shutting off a supply line at this place, but it's going to pop up someplace else. And if you make the compound itself illegal, then, and I know I've spoken to DEA agents about this, they come up with a new compound that's not illegal by changing in one way a minor difference in the compound, the chemical compound, etc. So is it kind of like a fallacy to think that we can approach this from the demand side, and when in fact we have to from the supply side, when in fact we have to really approach it from the demand side?
Well, I think that both the supply of opioids in our society as well as the demands are really important. I think those demands in large part are the legacy of over-prescribing prescription opioids. But at the same time, I don't think it's completely futile to think about the demand side of things. And in my mind, I think we need a couple of things that really should be the focus of health policy. One of them is to try to think about pain and pain syndromes in a more complex way, to stop thinking that pain is something that we can get rid of with a narcotic, and recognize that there's a whole social and psychological dimension to pain that often physicians aren't dealing with. And we need to start dealing with that. Part of that is offering a more comprehensive approach to pain that includes things like a psychologist for some patients, also using more fully the other strategies we might have, you know, even things as simple as physical therapy. So one approach to demand is to really do better at how we treat pain. The other is to recognize that there are people with opioid use disorder where we can reduce their harms by thinking about medication-assisted treatment. And essentially, this is the use of opioids as an ongoing way of controlling people's symptoms, particularly withdrawal symptoms, in such a way that they're not as prone to use illicit opioids. You know, traditionally, methadone was the drug used for medication-assisted treatment. We actually benefit these days by a newer drug called buprenorphine. Its brand name is Suboxone. Buprenorphine or Suboxone does a really great job of providing people with a level of opioids that controls their addiction without having the same risks of overdose. So I think what we need to do as a health policy measure is really make it much easier for people to receive medication-assisted treatment for their opioid use disorder or opioid addiction.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back. 937-2310. We're talking about the opioid epidemic in the country, which has not gone away just because we don't hear about it, because we're focused now on COVID-19, and rightfully so. But we'll continue the conversation when we come back. I'm Tommy Tucker. It is 937. That's time for traffic on WWL. 9:45, quarter till 10, couple of minutes left with Dr. Randall Stafford, nice enough to give us his time. Professor of Medicine at Stanford, as we talk about the opioid epidemic in a country that continues to I guess, fly beneath the surface of the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, but is getting worse and changing. Doctor, what do you think about the efforts of the Justice Department to sue Walmart and other big companies about unlawfully dispensing controlled substances? And I'll go back to my knee replacement, and you know, I had a legitimate need for pain medication, but a lot of pharmacies wouldn't even fill it. I had a hard time finding anywhere to get it filled, and this is after, you know, a legitimate serious surgery. How do you keep this from being abused and not hurt the people that need the legitimate medication or legitimately need the medication.
Yeah, you're bringing up a really good point, Tommy. I think that with our current attitudes towards opioid prescribing, you know, sometimes it's difficult for those people who really need short-term opioid therapy to get it as readily as they once did. On the other hand, you know, I think that part of the problem we're still living with is that at one point in time, we had, you know, enough opioids for this whole country to be taking several tablets a day. So, you know, it's really a balance of how do we put in place restrictions and try to keep those restrictions from not having harms like the ones you're describing. This is a, you know, this is a tough issue. I think that we're still trying to figure it out. And, you know, I think part of the problem is that we, in some sense, thought we had opioid prescribing and opioid problems under control, but that's not really the case. What we've really seen is a shifting problem and one that continues to really have enormous effects on, you know, young people, on the elderly, and on those people who are most vulnerable.
I got a text from a listener, Doctor, that asks, does Suboxone deal with the pain that a patient is having or strictly with the opioid dependency? And if that's the case, are you substituting one addictive medication for another? And the only difference is that the Suboxone is not as easy to overdose on.
Well, there is some truth to this. And, you know, but at the same time, I think it's really important recognize.
What part is true, Doc?
Well, both in some sense are true. I mean, part of the issue is that opioid use disorder or opioid addiction, you know, often goes along with continued chronic pain. Now, the problem is that once used chronically, opioids are not a particularly effective drug for reducing pain or increasing a person's function. So, you know, in some sense, it is using a different opioid. And Suboxone does have an effect on chronic pain, but its main use is for the opioid addiction. And because of the way it works, it kind of has this effect that maxes out at a certain level. And that level is insufficient to overdose. So part of the issue is that Suboxone provides a much safer way to treat opioid addiction compared to the use of other prescription opioids, or worse yet, a heroin supply that usually has quite a bit of fentanyl in it, making the overall potency of heroin very hard to predict.
So is Suboxone a better way to treat pain? And if so, why wouldn't doctors prescribe that, or am I jumping to conclusions?
Well, it's complicated. You know, I think that there are people advocating for greater use of Suboxone for pain because of that threshold effect. Now, on the other hand, you know, it's a more complicated way to take the medicine because it needs to be, in most cases, a little strip, a film that's held in the cheek to let the drug absorb into the system. So, you know, there are some reasons not to use it. It's also a rather powerful drug for those who have not been exposed to opioids in the past. So while I think there is some movement towards thinking about Suboxone for pain, it also is a drug that's under very strict control by the Drug Enforcement Agency. And in fact, you need a special waiver from the DEA to be able to prescribe Suboxone. And I think that one thing that would probably help our situation is for the DEA to not be so strict in terms of the control or restrictions on Suboxone use.
Is part of this because we as a society somehow have convinced ourselves that we should never be in pain and nothing should ever hurt?
I think that's a big part of the problem. And even the language we use, you know, to call opioids painkillers, or to use the way of tracking pain and this idea that pain at one point was considered a fifth vital sign, where you could rate your pain from none with a smiley face or, you know, 10 out of 10 with a very unhappy face. We've kind of created the expectation that pain is something we can get rid of completely. And that's rarely the case. People with chronic pain have to live with pain. And the goal of treatment really isn't to remove that pain. It's to get it so that that pain is, you know, over people's shoulder in the sense that they're distracted from it and they can go on and do other, they can do useful things with their lives, even with that pain. So I think you're absolutely right that we've created a culture where we feel that pain should be able to disappear or be removed completely. And the reality is that that's rarely the case. And to call opioids painkillers, I think, creates this expectation and creates this mismatch between what people expect and the reality of what they experience.
And I guess, Doctor, it goes back to pain management as opposed to pain removal, right? The idea is to manage it so you can get on with your life, not make it disappear completely.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate your time as always. I really do, and we'll talk to you again.
Sounds good, Tommy. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Thank you, Dr. Randall Stafford, professor of medicine at Stanford, and this opioid...
O'Reilly! Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.